And we've taken an approach that really resulted from something else that we've been studying, but I believe it fits the New Testament approach of the most important things in our lives. And what we've said is, if you let this little circle represent life, in other words, that which we all experience by reason of our living in this world, what the gospel teaches is that the Son of God took upon Himself the form of a man and dwelt among us and even experienced the worst that all of us can face. I mean, we can look around in this circle of life that we see and notice that something is wrong. I mean, you can listen just to the things that are brought up when we are saying, here's what we need to pray about. You can notice that something is wrong. We live in a world such that Lori's friend lost a little boy, no fault of his or of hers. It's just life. There is something wrong in this life that we, and we can fool ourselves all we want to. We can say that we're here to live and enjoy ourselves, and it's our own business, and it makes no difference how we live. It's up to everybody, and that type. We can say that all we want to, but there's something wrong. And Christ came and in the form of a man and dwelt among us and took on our worst enemy, which is death, and then overcame it. He was raised up, and the Christian is convicted of the fact that he lives even now at the right hand of God, where he rules over his kingdom. And so we've said that the first great evidence of the gospel or of Christianity is the resurrection of Christ. If the resurrection of Christ happens, it means that there is a God outside of this universe. There is a God outside of this natural creation who works upon it and within it. And if that worldview is true, then secularism is defeated, and all of the modern philosophies that suggest that reality comes from inside the individual, all of that's defeated if the resurrection of Christ occurred. And if the resurrection of Christ occurred, we're all responsible to Him. We're accountable to Him. And, of course, that's what the New Testament teaches. Now, we've said that the resurrection of Christ, the first natural consequence of the resurrection of Christ, is His church. There's no way to explain the sudden birth of and growth of the church of the Lord in the first third of the first century, apart from an event like the resurrection of Christ. There's no way to explain why lives would turn around, people would endure persecution, and why the gospel would spread unless there was the resurrection of Christ. And so the church is the new life that God has brought through His Son now finds its existence in the church. Now, we've said that the church members then portray both the resurrection and the new people, the new life and the new people. Let me write it so you can see what I'm saying. Here's new life. Here's new people. And here's a new lifestyle. New way of life, you want to think of it that way. And we talked about why we believe in the Christian approach to life, Christian moral standards and so forth. And then we have said that this new way of life begins to penetrate even the most personal relationships of life. And we have said that the strong evidence of Christianity is the new relationships that come because we are Christians. And we've been exploring especially the most personal one of these. We had to take a week or two off because of our being in other places, and the timing of that didn't fall exactly where I would have preferred, but the new relationship. And we've especially been exploring marriage. And we have said that marriage is presented in Scripture. And this is how our viewpoint of things change, because we believe in the resurrection of Christ. If you go about it without this, then marriage becomes a utilitarian way of trying to live more cheaply and tend to the chores of raising kids until you get tired of each other. If you approach it from the Christian viewpoint, then marriage becomes something altogether different. And we have learned these thoughts so far about marriage. First, it's God's creation. He makes us to correspond to each other as male and female. He does so for our own good. He means it to be not only for the good of the individual, but also for the good of the couple and for the good of the culture or the society in which they live. Marriage is a relationship which is like God's relationship with His people, which is entered by covenant. A covenant is not the same as a contract. It's not the same merely as a legal arrangement or as a state-endorsed relationship. It is entered by a covenant in which two people make a promise between themselves and God, and that he enters into it in that way. Marriage is something which is practiced by a God kind of love. That is, it is not something which is practiced by means of or for the sake of what I get out of it. There is no possible way that you can promise to love someone until death does you part. And until your journey's over, without intending, without committing yourself to love sometimes when that other person is not real lovable, doesn't really deserve it. You think about that. Now, how can you promise to be married still on Blue Monday or whatever your worst days are, practiced by a God kind of love? Now, because of this, and I want to quickly do something that really deserves more time this morning, because of this, of course, marriage is a relationship which is to be held in honor. In other words, the Christian begins to view relationship, and especially this one, as sacred, because the Christian believes that this is the place where the new people and their new life have their most personal responsibilities, where there's not any way now for you to farm this out or to expect somebody else in the church to meet the responsibilities for you or whatever. This is the new relationship. I want to comment about this just briefly. And let's do it by reading some verses. Matthew 19 and verse 6 would be a starting place. Tim, if you don't mind, get that for us. Jan, you get for me Exodus 20 and verses 4 and 17. And Coetta, get Hebrews 13 and verse 4. Now, my premise for what we're about to read is that God guards marriage because He knows that there is no promise or no relationship or no obligation in human experience which has more far-reaching consequences than this relationship does. I think what I'm suggesting is that these kinds of sayings take on even more power when we view it through this prism. It's already true, but when viewed through this prism, you can appreciate it even more so. Tim, this is a part of the text that we started with in this three-part section of our quarter here, if you'll read it for us.
So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate.
All right, now, the biblical view of marriage is such that there is no possible way to be practicing what the Bible is referring to unless you can expect it to be something which God has joined together. Okay. And because God joins it together, the idea is that man does not have the authority to separate it or to destroy it in that way. That's what the Lord said. That's what Jesus said was God's intention from the beginning. It didn't start with the law of Moses. It's not a new covenant arrangement. This is what God intended for the marriage relationship. Now, that would say to me, I think, that the more meaning we attach to anything, then the more we know it may be threatened, and the more security we put around it. Now, you think about the difference between the locks you put on the doors of your house versus the locks you put on the doors of your storage shed. One has a deadbolt, the other has, I don't know how yours is, mine doesn't really have a lock on it. In fact, I'm kind of hoping somebody gets into it without suing, of course, right? Anyway, you see what I'm getting at. The more precious something is, the more it's guarded. Now think about God in the Ten Commandments with His covenant people in the Old Testament days, Israel. Two of them deal with this. Look at these two statements now, Jan. First, Exodus 20, verse 14. This is the seventh commandment.
You shall not commit adultery.
All right, this is a pretty straightforward deal. Adultery is the joining of yourself or the sexual involvement with someone who is not someone to whom you're not married, someone who's not your husband or wife. The word for fornication or sexual immorality is engaging in promiscuous sexual activity in general. But when it involves married people, then adultery is involved. Adultery, by definition, it would seem to be, would be more than simply the physical act itself. Because what makes it adultery to start with is the fact that a vow is being broken. So you think of it in those terms. Now, God says among His people, don't do that. Now, verse 17.
You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor.
All right, what does covet mean? What does it mean to covet something? All right, Chatty says to want. Can you go farther than that with anyone?
Desire, wanting to make it yours.
All right, it is wanting or desiring something for which you have no right. The intention to make yours something which is not yours. And notice it says you shall not covet what your neighbor's house or his wife, because this relationship is to be guarded. Now Hebrews 13 verse 4, go read it.
Marriage should be honored by all, and the marriage bed kept pure, for God will judge the adulterer and all the sexually immoral.
All right. Now you notice in this case, marriage being held in honor especially involves the guarding of the marriage bed, or the relationship that we are talking about, which God created us to correspond with each other in, and for our good, God intends for that to be held in honor. The two ways in which it would not be held in honor would be sexual immorality or adultery. And it says here that God would judge that kind of behavior, because you see it is a betrayal of what He has designed. And we put in a good bit of development of trying to notice these ideas here already. God guards marriage because He knows that there is no promise that has more far-reaching consequences than this one does. And if you just think for a moment, friends, about our our present culture right now in the United States, right now, you may have noticed there's been a huge argument going on about the debt ceiling. Anybody noticed? You haven't seen that? You have been one of the wise people who stayed away from the TV, haven't you? One of the ideas that I think when I watch that is, I wonder how much of that problem would be immediately healed if we could just simply ask everybody to respect this. How much of the spending would be taken care of if there were not the need to try to correct the hurt that we bring into life by ignoring this one point? That's what I mean by consequences here. Now, the wisdom of the Bible, in other words, that which speaks to us about how to apply God's ways to everyday life, especially seems to me to focus on the consequences of our behavior in our family relationship, and especially in our marriage. Now, I give you three examples from the Proverbs here, right quick. First, Proverbs 5 in verse 22. Jeff, would you mind to look that up for us? Eddie, get Proverbs 6 in verse 34. And Linda, if you don't mind, would you get Proverbs 5 in verse 21? Now, here's a memory crutch for you. In the New Testament, the Sermon on the Mount is Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. In the Old Testament, the passages that talk especially about our love relationship, as we would refer to it, and especially our sexual purity, would be Proverbs chapters 5, 6, and 7. All three chapters are the education of a young man and a young woman in this area of their life. And one of the things that it says is that a man's or woman's behavior in this way will have a huge impact on himself or herself throughout life. Now, look at Proverbs 5 and verse 22. And this that Jeff is about to read is in the context. All three of these chapters, as I've just mentioned, are talking about this one part of life. All right, Jeff, read what it says.
His own iniquities entrap the wicked man. He is caught in the cords of his sin.
All right, now just think about that for a minute. His own iniquities entrap the wicked man, and he is caught or held fast in the cords of his sin. What that's talking about is, in that section, is about the practice of sexual impurity or involvement with someone who's not a husband, the one's husband or wife. Now, just think in recent the last month or two or three of the things there have been in the national news where some political leader, and without launching too far into politics, you guys who believe that government is the answer to our problems ought to think about the people who are in these positions, you know. Who would take a picture of his private parts and send it over, what was it, Twitter or something like that? And then once that kind of thing is done, how hard is that trap to get out of? How many different stories? Which one got him out of it? You know which one it was? It hadn't been done yet. He got down to I quit, but he's still not out of it. All right. Now, that's one thing. God is not trying to keep us from enjoying ourselves to the hilt. He's trying to keep us out of that kind of stuff, that kind of a trap. All right. Now, look at this one. This one shows that this will impact the lives of other people. Lori Reed, Proverbs 6:34. Same context, but listen what this says.
I have that.
Okay, Ed, excuse me. Lori, I'm sorry about that. Ed?
For jealousy is a husband's fury. Therefore, he will not spare in the days of vengeance.
All right. In other words, love being what it is. If a husband loves his wife, he will be jealous of that relationship. Jealousy is used in the bad sense and the good sense in the Bible. In the good sense, God himself is jealous. He's a jealous God. He wants the hearts of those he loves. Now, you can't have a one-flesh relationship where a husband loves his wife without him not being moved to jealousy when a third party intrudes into that private relationship. And that's what this is saying. Jealousy makes a man furious. He won't spare when he takes revenge. And again, we all of us have heard stories about what happens with that kind of thing. There are tragedies that occur in this way. And then in the third case, when God's way with this is dishonored, it'll have some consequences in the person's relationship to the Lord. And you have to think about this. This is same context again, Proverbs 5 and verse 21. Linda?
For a man's ways are in full view of the Lord, and he examines all his paths.
All right. Man's ways are in full views of the Lord. I don't know how many of you are old country song experts. I'm not. But I remember, and I'm trying to think, he's the same guy who wrote, "There's only two things in the world money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes." a real moving, old anthem. Who was it? Is that it? All right. He wrote a song about sneaking around, too. I'm not sure that's exactly the right word to it, but what it had to do with is this idea that, you know, what two grown people do in their private lives, nobody else ever knows about. That's the part of the lure to it. And especially now that you introduce electronic sneaking around into the process as well. But think about what that passage just said. The Lord, it's in full view. A man's ways are before the eyes of the Lord. In other words, now that idea is crucial indeed. Now, the general idea. Hopefully, we've laid enough of it before us to see what we're trying to get at. God intends for there to be a closeness possible in our marriage relationship, which is the next thing to our closeness to Him, and that's why in the Bible this relationship is used as an illustration of Christ and His church, or in the book of Hosea, of God and His people, and that's what we're looking for. Tom, you had a comment before I move.
I've got a question.
Okay.
You've got one word written up there that I think is very, very important, and that is sacred.
Yeah.
And to me, the word means something beyond human concept or human reason. Would it be safe to say then that the major problem as we view marriage compared to what our society is viewing marriage, particularly in this issue of same-sex marriage, is the sacred nature?
Yes.
And we as Christians look at it.
Yes, it'd be safe to say. What I mean by it is the fact that God made it and it's his creation, his idea, means that it's holy. And the fact that we are responding to that in marriage means that it's sacred. And from our point of view, that the sacred idea is that it belongs to God. I want to read you now two secular quotes about the love which it takes to make this relationship to work. And I have a point with this, so bear with me for just a second. This statement: for one human being to love another, that is perhaps the most difficult of all tasks, the ultimate, the last test and proof the work for which all other work is but preparation. And he's talking about loving each other like we've talked about here. In other words, this gets to be the toughest work of life, but also the one which may be the crowning achievement in life. Or think about what two people may work through throughout a lifetime. I heard two of our younger counselors at camp. I walked by and heard them talking last week in the pavilion. Brian, they had a deep discussion going, and I stopped to listen. They were talking about how long people they knew had been married. Man, 20 years already. And I just mentioned, you kids don't know what you're talking about, you know, that kind of thing. But you think about that. Now listen to this statement. The greatest need of the human soul is to love and to be loved. What do you think of that one? To love and to be loved. All right, now. This one. Decades of social research, this is not a religious writer here, social writer. Decades of social research have confirmed the deepest intuitions of the human heart. As frightening, exhilarating, and improbable as this wild vow of constancy may seem, there is no substitute. When love seeks permanence, a safe home for children who long for both parents, when men and women look for someone they can count on, there are no substitutes. The word for what we want is marriage. All right, now, here is what I'm getting at. The difficulty of this is, in this relationship, we are made to realize most clearly that while we may be a new people, where are we still living? While we are new people who have new standards, where are we still living? Is there in this world, or is there any place where you realize your imperfections more than in your relationship with the person that you married? She'll tell you. I mean, that's the thing. She'll tell you. When you are trying to pursue your own best intentions, where you say that I should have thought more than that? I shouldn't have said that. I should have known better. I should have considered more carefully. Is there any place where that strikes you more than in this relationship here? No, there isn't. If you think there is, you're not thinking very clearly. What that means is, where does that drive you? Do you say, all right, I'm out of this circle, I quit? Or does it drive you again to the resurrection of Christ, to new life, where there is hope, forgiveness? Let's try to do better. And aren't we saying here that God has set in motion something through the resurrection of His Christ and through the gospel, which has circles that continue to grow and reach out and improve and mature and develop, but still always keep coming back to the resurrection of Christ? I want you to take a look with me for just a second, and we got like 2 minutes here, at the book of Colossians. A crucial word in the book of Colossians is the word hidden. H-I-D-D-E-N. Hidden. And maybe this is written to some philosophers who believe that they were the source of the hidden secrets of life that everybody has always been looking for. But Colossians says in 1:26 that the mystery hidden for ages and generations has now been revealed to God's saints. What's been hidden is revealed. In 2:3, it says that in Christ, the mystery which is in Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. You see that? Now look at...
I'm very sorry. Can I get Russell? I need him for a minute.
Okay.
Russell, sorry to interrupt him.
Thanks for your work, Russ. All right. Did everybody see what I'm getting at? Now skip down with me to 3:3. Let me read 1 through 4 of Colossians chapter 3. If then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Now look at the inescapable logic of that statement. If you've been raised with Christ, you seek the things where Christ is. Verse 2, set your minds on things that are above and not on things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. All right, now look at this. Christ was raised, but what had to happen before he was raised? He died. Now, I've been raised with Christ in the gospel. And so have you. If you've obeyed the gospel, God raised you up. Chapter 2 and verse 12 of Colossians said that. So now let me remember that in order for that to happen, I died. My life is now hidden with Him. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you will appear with Him in glory. But now look at the way Colossians starts to work this out. Notice now carefully exactly where we've been. The evidence of the gospel is the resurrection of Christ. That has produced a people who have been delivered out of the domain of darkness and translated into the Son of His love. Chapter 1, verse 13, 14. Those people now have a new life. They seek the things that are above where Christ is. Look how this works out. You notice that people who've died with Christ, now they begin to put to death what is earthly. End in verse 5. And this includes sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, covetousness, which is idolatry. And it includes anger, wrath, malice, slander, and obscene talk and lying, verses 8 and 9. The reason being because you've put on the new man, which is being renewed in knowledge after the image of its creator, where Christ is all and in all, verses 10 and 11. Now, that means that there is a new people. Look at verse 12. Put on as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved. Did the bell ring? It did, didn't it? Look at my watch. Let me just ask you to notice. Notice in verses 12 and following, there's a behavior of a new people that's involved. Then notice that this involves the new way of life I'm talking about. And then notice it involves new treatment of your family, verses 18 and 19, and of your extended household, verses 20 and following. And in every way, the idea would be that Christ be glorified. And you keep turning back to the resurrection of Jesus. We do it on the first day of every week. And that helps us to, maybe that gives us a glimpse of why we have something to believe in and to live for. I apologize to you for keeping you late, but in all fairness, I started late. Thank you guys. Everybody have a good week.